forlorn outpost on the border with Sichuan. The river that flows through a red sandstone valley picks up the sediment and gives the place its name, which means red water. In March 1935, the Red Army crossed the river several times, turning the county into holy ground keenly promoted by local leaders after the revolution. Up in the Scarlet Mountains, small villages were hidden among giant tree ferns and bright green bamboo, but most of the people grew paddy and sugarcane along the river and its tributaries. Between October 1959 and April 1960, around 24,000 people died, more than 10% of the population. Wang Linqi, a relatively young man at 35, was in charge of the county. He was given a coveted red flag in 1958 and was commended by the central leadership for having transformed a backwater into a 5,000-kilo county, thanks to the many innovations heralded by the Great Leap Forward. In Shishui, under Wang Lingqi, deep ploughing meant digging to a depth of 1 to 1.5 meters, the deeper the better. Large quantities of seed were used, often 200 to 450 kilos per hectare, but at times as much as a ton or two, sometimes even 3 tons. Among other great schemes devised by the county leadership was an irrigation project in which water would be conveyed through a network of bamboo pipes to every plot in the county. "Water pipes in the skies of Qishui" was the slogan, but the scheme failed miserably after acres of bamboo forest were chopped down, depriving the villages of a much-needed resource. The result of the Great Leap Forward in Qishui was a plummeting grain output and the virtual extermination of the livestock. But Wang was determined to maintain his reputation. As early as September 1958, many months before Zhao Ziyang's report on the hiding of grain in Guangdong, he decreed that a part of the crop was being withheld by rich peasants and bad elements in a sustained attack on the socialist system. A merciless counterattack with armed carders was required to save the communes and prevent a counter-revolution. People on the ground were terrorized. A year later, in the wake of the Lushan Plenum, villages were divided into poor peasants and rich peasants. Behind the backs of rich peasants stood the landlords, saboteurs, counter-revolutionaries and other elements who were bent on wrecking the revolution. "Poor and rich peasants, this struggle is to the death." Several thousand carders were expelled from the party for having the wrong class background, while mass demonstrations, struggle meetings and anti-hiding campaigns were organized to root out every class enemy. Like Mao, Wang Lingqi was a poet, composing verses to celebrate the working class and organizing a traditional opera in which he starred as the main actor, before hundreds of invited guests tucking into a lavish banquet. In the meantime, agriculture was neglected. Although in January 1960, Wang announced to his superiors in Guiyang a bumper crop of 33,500 tons, 80% of this amount existed on paper only. Wang Lingqi was hardly a unique case in Guizhou, a radical province led by Zhou Lin, a close follower of Mao. Everywhere, Zhou Lin tacitly encouraged a radical approach to the Great Leap Forward, resulting in one of the highest death rates in the country. In Meitan, famous for its tea, 45,000 people died in 6 months. Wang Xinchun, the first party secretary, deployed a labor force of 50,000 at will, building giant tea gardens, orchards, irrigation systems and communal buildings that would turn Meitan into a national model. 40,000 pigs were requisitioned for a 10,000-hog city. Anybody critical of these schemes was accused of stirring an evil revisionist trend and given the label of rightist opportunist. In 1960, an arrest many and detain many campaign was organized by the police and the militia, sweeping across the region and locking up close to 3,000 people in a month. A simple slogan seemed to capture the Métan spirit. Those who are unable to produce grain will not be given any grain. The figure of 45,000 deaths is very high, but even so it may be an underestimate. According to an investigation by the Provincial Party Committee, in one commune alone 12,000 people died of starvation, representing 22% of the population. Focusing on one village, a more detailed inquest showed how over a third of the farmers died. Nong Cha was once a relatively prosperous village, in which each family owned a few ducks and chickens, but by 1961 the crop had decreased to a third of what had been produced in 1957. Vegetables were hard to come by. Sugarcane production, indispensable for local farmers to trade against food and goods, was virtually wiped out. Many of the fields lay destroyed after experiments in deep ploughing and land reclamation. Some were called moon plots because the pockmarked terrain would no longer retain any water. No work points were ever kept, and villagers were fed according to the whims of local carders in chaotic canteens. Personal property was seized. Private plots were abolished. State procurements were sky-high, despite falling grain production. In 1959, three-quarters of the crop was dragged away by state agents, leaving the villagers to starve. By 1961, one pig was left in the entire village. When an inspection team was scheduled to visit Métan in April 1960, the local leaders scurried about day and night to bury corpses in mass graves by the side of the road. Sick villagers and neglected children were locked up and guarded by the militia, while telltale trees without bark were torn out, roots and all. Travelling through the region in March 1960, Ni Zhongjun was ecstatic about Guizhou in a letter to Mao. "In fact, Guizhou is not poor at all. It is very rich. In future, it should be our industrial base in the southwest." As the Yellow River nears the end of its long journey across the Loess Plateau, it intersects with the Grand Canal, an ancient man-made river completed in the 7th century to haul the grain tribute from the south to the imperial capital in the north. It is said that more than 47,000 labourers were needed to maintain the canal system, which was used at its height in the mid-15th century by some 11,000 grain barges. Cihe is the main river port in Shandong, lying just northwest of Xinan, and it should have fared well thanks to its strategic location on the Yellow River. Before the Great Leap Forward, it was known as a grain store, with an abundant crop that managed to reach 200,000 tons in a good year for a population of roughly 500,000. Cotton, tobacco and fruit were also widely cultivated. By 1961, Cihe County had lost well over 100,000 people, or a fifth of its population compared to 1957. Half of the workers who had survived or stayed behind were sick. The economy lay in tatters. The 200,000 tons of grain harvested in 1956 had dwindled to a mere 16,000 a few years later. The collapse in peanut production was even more dramatic. Whereas 7,780 tons had been taken from the fields in 1956, a pitiful 10 tons was all that could be gathered by 1961. Everything, it seemed, was reduced to about one-tenth of what could have been expected before 1958. Even the land under cultivation had shrunk, as a fifth was taken away for waterworks and roads, most of which were never finished. As everywhere in the north, the amount of alkaline soil doubled, reaching almost a third of the surface under cultivation. Despite, or rather as a consequence of, massive investment in water conservancy projects, the overall irrigated surface shrank by 70%. Off the fields, the devastation was just as visible. Livestock was more than halved. The number of carts dwindled, while tens of thousands of simple tools such as rakes and hoes had vanished. Over half of all the trees had been felled. Of all the housing in the county, 38% had been destroyed. Of what was left standing, a quarter was heavily damaged and needed urgent attention. Some 13,000 families did not even have a single room left to themselves. Hung Juang was one of the many hamlets in Si He County. It had 240 villages in 1957, but by 1961 only 141 remained. A quarter of the village had died of hunger, one in six families having been entirely extinguished, a fact which always carried a great deal of weight in a culture which continued to emphasize dissent, despite all the official rhetoric of class war. Between 1958 and 1961, only four children had been born in the village, one of whom had died in infancy. Many villagers were single. Most were weak or sick, and few women from other villages were willing to marry local men. The village had lost some 40% of its land, and well over half of what remained was almost barren through heavy salinization. According to a local saying, on leaving the house one beholds a white expanse, as the salt whitened the earth for as far as the eye could see. In the midst of this thin, exhausted land stood derelict mud huts. The village had boasted a total of 240 rooms, but a mere 80 remained standing, most of them with leaky roofs or walls that had caved in. There was nothing inside these miserable dwellings, as an inspection team revealed. All the families have gone bankrupt through the famine. Those least affected have sold all their clothes and furniture, while the most damaged ones have had to sell their pots, bowls and basins, as well as the wood stripped from their houses. In the village, 27 families have sold everything they had. Yang Ji Mao, for instance, left the village in 1960. His wife and child could survive only by selling every possession. They had no bed, no pots, and no tools to cultivate the land. They shared a ragged blanket and a threadbare coat. Others were worse off. Among the few people who had stayed in Hang Chuang was Liu Zailin, aged 33, who soon died of hunger. His wife hanged herself from a rafter, leaving behind two children who were adopted by local villagers. In Shandong, the teams sent to investigate what had happened during the famine were coy about pointing the finger at abusive cadres, unlike their peers in Gansu or Guangdong. But the political dimensions of the famine were clear. The head of the village had changed 15 times since the Great Leap Forward. Few could do anything to resist punitive procurements imposed from above. And in 1959, the villagers were left with an average of 25 kilos of grain per person for the entire year. Widespread conscription of labour on irrigation projects did not help. In the winter of 1959-60, 46 of the best labourers were recruited from Hang Chuang. They worked for 40 days and nights on end, in the snow, but were not given any grain, which had to be supplied by the village, already depleted by state requisitions. Some died while digging earth outside in the cold, others dropped dead by the roadside on the way home. Across the Shandong countryside there were countless villages in a similar predicament, broken by 4 years of mass abuse. Early warning signs had appeared in April 1959. Tang Silong, a senior leader in Shandong, personally witnessed how in several counties in the Jining region the trees had been stripped bare, children were abandoned and farmers died along the roadside, their faces sallow from hunger. In Zhuye, people ate the straw from their pillows. Thousands died of hunger. Tan Si Long reported this situation to provincial boss Xu Tong, but also took the exceptional step of sending a copy to Mao Zedong. A few weeks later, a contrite Xu Tong had to explain the Jining incident to the chairman, who was passing through the region in his special train. But Xu Tong did nothing to alleviate the famine. By his own admission, he detested bad news and refused even to talk about one finger of shortcomings in Shandong, threatening those who were critical of the Great Leap Forward with the label of rightist conservatism. According to others who had to work alongside Xu Tong, the regional Tsar exploded in a violent rage when anybody prevented him from enforcing a utopian vision that had cost the lives of countless people. He who strikes first prevails. He who strikes last fails. Xu Tong religiously followed Mao's advice about seizing the grain before the farmers could eat it, enforcing vast procurements to satisfy the demands from Beijing. Gansu, Sichuan, Guizhou, Shandong. All these provinces contained counties where the death rate was above 10% in 1960. But nothing was as bad as Anhui, run by Zheng Xisheng, one of Mao's most devoted followers. Like other provinces, Anhui was divided into regions, having over a dozen. One of these regions was Fuyang. Fuyang had a population of 8 million in 1958. 3 years later, more than 2.4 million people had died. One of the reasons for the high death rate was the landscape itself. Flat and generally barren, it offered few places to hide. Many of those who wanted to flee the area followed the river into Xinjiang, in neighbouring Henan, where the famine was even worse. The Huai River itself was a web of death. In 1957, it became the focus of a huge irrigation project which commanded up to 80% of the labour force. Every hectare would have a duct, every 10 hectares a canal, and every 100 hectares a large waterway. Fields would be as smooth as a mirror, deep ploughing making the soil as pliable as dough. Fuyang would catch up with the future in a mere year or two. Slogans such as, "On a rainy day we see a bright day, the night becomes the day," and "In daytime we fight the sun, at night we battle the stars," were behind the ceaseless exploitation of the best workers along the river. Many succumbed to disease, exhaustion, and death. To prevent workers from returning home over the Chinese New Year, the militia sealed their homes. With the inexorable advance of dams, dikes, and channels, everything in the way was flattened. Trees, graves, even large bridges were torn down, forcing farmers to walk for several kilometres each day to attend to the fields. Entire villages were compelled to relocate overnight at the whim of a carter. Hundreds simply vanished from the map. Other giant schemes took away the best workers from the fields before the sowing or reaping was even completed. So abundant was the crop, the party line went, that grain should be turned into alcohol. Hao County, striving to become a 5,000-ton county, built more than 3,200 alcohol factories in January 1959. Less than half ever worked, and many tons of grain went to waste. Just as ruinous were efforts to mechanize agriculture. Clunky iron wheels were added to some 10,000 carts, which were so heavy that bulls could no longer pull them. To compound the problem, the old carts were banned from the roads, and farmers seen to use them were denounced as rightists. The grain output plunged, but zealous carters doubled it on paper. Punitive requisitions followed, carried out with routine violence. They sometimes extracted close to 90% of the actual crop. To compensate for the shortage in grain, carters burst into local households and carried away tables, chairs, and beds. Farmers were even forced to turn in a set amount of cotton clothes, up to several kilos per family. Failure to fulfill the quota led to a ban from the canteen. Zhao Huaijun had to hand over the cotton jackets of his 70-year-old mother and his child. In the freezing cold, they had to bury themselves underneath some straw to keep warm. By 1960, there was so little left to collect that in one commune the biggest haul consisted of 100 coffins. Torture was rampant. iron wire was used to pierce the ears of bad elements, while women were stripped and suspended by their hair. In the words of a leader in Jiaoshu County, their breasts were twisted until liquid oozed out. In Linsuan, the use of violence was summarized as follows by the local party boss. People died in tragic circumstances, being beaten and hanged to death, deprived of food or buried alive. Some were severely tortured and beaten, having their ears chopped off, their noses dug out, their mouths torn off, and so on, which often caused death. We discovered how extremely serious all of this was once we started investigating. Murder was common. In Daohuazhuang, a small village in Lichuan, 9 out of 19 carders had killed at least one villager during the famine. Li Fengying, a team leader, killed 5 people. In some cases, villagers were deliberately entrapped. In late 1959, at the height of the famine, one of the food processing factories belonging to the local grain bureau in Funan County left bean cakes in a courtyard with the gates wide open. As starving farmers tried to pilfer the food, the gates were suddenly locked behind them. Some of those who were caught were forced into a grain sack that was tied at the end. Then they were beaten with iron bars. The sacks were covered in blood. Others had their faces carved by knives and then oil rubbed into the wounds. Help for the famished was withheld. 15 tons of grain sent to support those in need in one county alone were confiscated, hastening the deaths of thousands. People also died when the local authorities tried to hide the famine from inspection teams. The militia, for instance, were instructed to seal off the villages and not allow anyone with signs of starvation onto the streets. In one commune targeted for a visit by the Ministry of Interior in 1960, the county head scrambled to round up and hide more than 3,000 villagers with edema. Locked up without any medical support, several hundred died in a matter of days. A local carder had a quick look at Sin Chonchua, who was one of those suffering from edema. "He won't live. Bury him quickly," he ordered, as an inspection team was on its way. "He was still breathing while being buried," concluded the local party secretary. Chapter 36. Cannibalism. The countryside was a world of noise before the famine. Hawkers filled the air with their chants, some using rattles to advertise their wares. The din of gongs, cymbals, and firecrackers traditionally accompanied popular events, whether a burial or a wedding. Loudspeakers nailed to trees by street corners and village squares blasted out propaganda and revolutionary music. Passing trucks and buses, clouds of yellow dust billowing behind them, would have worked their horns incessantly. Boisterous conversations were yelled across fields, so loud that outsiders might mistake them for a bitter argument. But after years of famine, an eerie, unnatural silence descended upon the countryside. The few pigs that had not been confiscated had died of hunger and disease. Chickens and ducks had long since been slaughtered. There were no birds left in the trees, which had been stripped of their leaves and bark, their bare and bony spines standing stark against an empty sky. People were often famished beyond speech. In this world, plundered of every layer that might offer sustenance, down to bark and mud, corpses often ended up in shallow graves or simply by the roadside. A few people ate human flesh. This began in Yunnan, where the famine started in the summer of 1958. At first, the carcasses of diseased livestock were unearthed. But as famine tightened its grip, some people eventually dug up, boiled and ate human bodies. Soon the practice appeared in every region decimated by starvation, even in a relatively prosperous province such as Guangdong. For example, in Tanbin, Luoding, a commune where 1 in 20 villagers died in 1960, several children were eaten. Few archives offer more than an oblique reference to cannibalism, but some police reports are quite detailed. In a small village in Sili County, Gansu, villagers caught the whiff of boiling meat from the hut of a neighbour. They reported the man to the village secretary, who suspected that a sheep might have been stolen and proceeded to inspect the premises. He discovered flesh stored in vats, as well as a hair clip, ornaments, and a scarf buried at the bottom of a pit. The artifacts were immediately identified as the belongings of a young girl who had vanished from the village days earlier. The man not only confessed to the murder, but also owned up to having unearthed and eaten the corpses of young children on two previous occasions. After the village had taken measures to protect the graves from desecration, he had turned to murder. Human flesh, like everything else, was traded on the black market. A farmer who bartered a pair of shoes for a kilo of meat at the Jiangye railway station found that the package contained a human nose and several ears. He decided to report the finding to the local public security bureau. To escape detection, human flesh was sometimes mixed with dog meat when sold on the black market. But few reports were ever systematically compiled. Under a regime in which the mere mention of famine could land a cadre in trouble, cases of cannibalism were covered up wherever they appeared. In Gansu province, the provincial leader Zhang Zhongliang was personally told of a string of cases in Tongwei, Yumen, Wushan, Jingying, and Wudu, but he dismissed the evidence out of hand, blaming bad elements. Xu Dong, leader of Shandong, also suppressed evidence about cannibalism, fearing that adverse news would harm his reputation. Wang Lingqi, the county leader of Qishui, one of the sites of horror covered in the previous chapter, took the local security forces to task for arresting villagers guilty of cannibalism. So unmentionable was the topic that in a report distributed to the party leadership, the blame for the practice was placed on saboteurs who had tried to tarnish the reputation of the party by exhuming human bodies, pretending to eat them, in order to publicize the extent of the famine. A few fairly comprehensive documents have survived. One of these was compiled in March 1961 by a municipal unit in Linxia, a city south of Lanzhou. Linxia was heavily influenced by Islam, populated predominantly by Hui people, and the capital of a region with a dozen other ethnic minorities, including Tibetans, Sala, Bawan, and Dongxiang. The region suffered from mass collectivization during the Great Leap Forward, which ran roughshod over the habits and customs of minorities. An investigation of the region in the immediate aftermath of the famine showed that 54,000 people had died in a mere 2 years. The report listed some 50 cases discovered in the city, not in the entire region, all comprehensively arranged in the kind of list that was so much in favour with the planners, reducing horror to a mere set of facts and figures. Here are the details of four such cases. Date, 25th of February 1960. Location, Hongtai Commune, Yaohechia Village. Name of culprit, Yang Zhongsheng. Status, poor farmer. Number of people involved, 1. Name of victim, Yang Ershun. Relationship with culprit, younger brother. Number of people involved, 1. Manner of crime, killed and eaten. Reason, livelihood issues. Date, void. Location, void. Name of culprit, Ma Manai. Status, poor farmer. Number of people involved, entire family of 4. Name of victim, void. Relationship with culprit, void. Number of people involved, 13. Manner of crime, corpses exhumed and eaten. Reason, livelihood issues. Date, the 9th of January, 1960. Location, Maizi Commune, Zhang Shama Village. Name of culprit, Gang Gamai. Status, poor farmer. Number of people involved, 1. Name of victim, Maha Machi.